from NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Day two of the Senate impeachment trial of President Donald Trump yesterday. House Democratic managers began their opening arguments. Here's Representative Hakeem Jeffries of New York.
We are here, sir, to follow the facts, apply the law, be guided by the Constitution, and present the truth to the American people. That is why we are here, Mr. Sekulow. And if you don't know, now you know.
The facts, the law, the Constitution. In a perfectly functioning system of democratic governance, this is the arc that a somber impeachment proceeding would follow. But the Senate right now is traveling a legal arc distorted by politics. So we wanted to know how constitutional scholars are looking at this moment. What are they hearing in the arguments being laid out in the Senate chamber? This hour on Point, the Constitution and impeachment. And you can join us if you've been watching the arguments laid out by House managers over many hours yesterday. What stood out to you? What questions do you have about the original intention of the framers when what they said about impeachment in the Constitution? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, joining us today in the studio is Lawrence Tribe. He's been a professor of constitutional law at Harvard University for more than 50 years. He assisted House Democrats in preparing for the impeachment proceedings. He's also the author of many books, including To End a Presidency, The Power of Impeachment and the Constitution. Professor Larry Tribe, welcome to On Point.
Very good to be here, Meghna.
Also joining us today from Chicago, Allison LaCroix. She's a professor of law and history at the University of Chicago, and she's the author of The Ideological Origins of American Federalism, amongst many other books as well. Professor LaCroix, welcome to you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So first of all, I wonder if you both might put on sort of your actually instructional hat here. And say you were speaking to a group of your law students. And Professor LaCroix, I'll start with you. Is there a particular moment or moments from what we saw last night in the House manager's opening arguments that you would say, watch, pay attention to that? That's important.
Yes. Well, I think there were a few moments, and definitely these are the moments that are hard to incorporate, but all the more incorporate into classroom discussions. So I think what we saw yesterday coming from Representative Schiff and others was a statement of the case in constitutional terms. So saying things like the president has engaged in a corrupt scheme to press a foreign nation for assistance to cheat, that's Representative Schiff's phrase, in the election. And that's not something that you would see in a criminal indictment in a criminal case. That is constitutional language about interfering with another part of the Constitution, the election process. And in the impeachment counts as well, the obstruction of Congress count, interference with another branch's constitutional power. So these are obviously foundational values in the Constitution. They have fuzzy lines. But this process on the first day, I think, illustrates that we have both separated powers, but also checks and balances, to go back to high school civics. And figuring out when it's supposed to be separation and when they're supposed to be checking is our task as lawyers and citizens, frankly.
As a legal argument, is what Schiff presented effective?
Well, I think it's effective in framing, and that's obviously a big part of opening statements. So it's striking that the president's team so far seems to be making the argument that we should be viewing this as like a criminal trial. So the president's chief counsel, Jay Sekulow, said yesterday, let them try their case. We'll try our case. The president will be acquitted. That sounds like criminal proceeding. That sounds like law and order. And I think that is one way of framing what's happening, which also then might suggest, as some of the president's other lawyers have said, these need to be charges framed in terms of violations of federal law. Mm. But the House manager's point is more, no, this is impeachment is about offenses to the system, to the public trust. And so they don't have the same kind of obligation to show that a specific federal law has been violated. So it's a framing maneuver.
I see. So, Professor Tribe, then, same question to you. What was the moment or moments that you think we should be paying particular attention to?
Well, for me, that's not exactly a hypothetical question, because I'm about to start teaching a seminar on protecting constitutional democracy. Needless to say, most of the materials are drawn from history, but a great many of the materials are drawn from what's happening every day. And Adam Schiff, another former student of mine, one that I'm very proud of at the moment, framed things, as Allison says, really quite beautifully. And it would be hard to pick any one moment. I'm going to have to try to figure out which moments to focus on. But I agree with Allison that a central theme is the question of what the impeachment power is for and how it differs from convicting someone in an ordinary trial. Just for starters, there's no punishment. The Constitution was clear that the most that you can do, and it's pretty big, but the most that you can do is kick someone out of office and disqualify them from future office. It's a preventive mechanism. It's not a punitive mechanism. It's designed to prevent someone from destroying the constitutional system, the constitutional order. And that has many implications, both procedural in terms of what the trial is supposed to be like and substantive in terms of what sorts of malfeasance you must charge. The scary thing for me is what's going to emerge really today in the trial. As we watch the president's men, and they're all men, of course, it's all white men, that's what they do. As we watch all the president's men make the bizarro argument, bizarro for those of us who've studied the Constitution, that unless you can show a standard crime, you know, like burglary or whatever, you can't remove someone for destroying the constitutional order. That's a profound mistake, but it's such a nice bumper sticker. My former colleague Alan Dershowitz makes the stupid argument. Stupid, you know, that's the technical term, I suppose. He makes the stupid argument that is going to be brilliant politically, and that is no crime, no foul. No crime, no removal. Well, that's not right, but it sure sounds good for people who haven't followed all of this and haven't thought about it.
Yeah, and to your point, it actually may be extremely politically effective if we're looking down the road to November of this year. But let me just play a moment from what Adam Schiff said yesterday in the Senate. Here is where lead House Manager Schiff said that not holding the president accountable would signal to future generations that the interests of a president take precedent over the nation's interests.
President Trump's abuse of powers of his office undermined the integrity of our free and fair elections and compromised America's national security. If we don't stand up to this peril today, we will write the history of our decline with our own hand.
Adam Schiff yesterday in the Senate. Professor LaCroix, let me turn back to you here, because in hearing both of you talk about the fact that the House managers are offering a framing for impeachment here, just put yourself for a moment, if you could, in the shoes of the president's defense team. What is the most maybe best and effective actually are two different things in this case. But what is the argument that you would make, the counter argument that you would make if you were indeed one of the president's defense lawyers right now?
Well, I think we're starting to see hints of that as we've discussed. One strategy or line of strategy would be procedural objections. So I think last night, Adam Schiff returned and urged the senators to demand documents and witness testimony, and those motions will be permitted after the opening arguments and the question and answer session. And that, I think, is setting the Senate up to demand these specific pieces of evidence. On the president's side, I think a good lawyer would be planning to object to those demands and indeed to any documents and testimony that are admitted, and making arguments from broad executive power, saying things like, these are privileged materials. The Senate doesn't have any power to demand them. And there, I mean, I think we've also seen in other comments the president's lawyers saying, look, House Democrats, you should have gone to court to demand these documents. And there they're citing Supreme Court case law indirectly, cases involving President Richard Nixon, U.S. versus Nixon, 1974. But that case isn't as good for them as I think they think, because the Supreme Court there talked about the president not having a blanket absolute privilege that was not susceptible to judicial review. But I think that's the kind of argument that they would make and are making, which is to say it inheres in the nature of the presidency to be permitted to have confidential discussions with advisors, and so the president will be hampered in his or her powers if they can't do that. But I'm not sure it's a great argument to say, listen, House Democrats, you have the constitutional power of impeachment, as does the Senate as far as removal. You should have started a case in federal court to demand documents. I mean, again, that's the sort of mainstreaming into a regular criminal trial where we will all then be told things like they haven't met their burden of proof and so on. But it's a little bit bizarre, as Larry said, to say, don't use your special constitutional power, just channel this through the federal courts. And it's not as though then they would start turning over documents either. I think that's sort of fantastical.
Professor Tribe, what do you think?
Well, I hate to give my best thoughts about this because I don't think the lawyers on the president's side are all that great. But one thing that I think they ought to be doing, though I imagine they've thought about this a little, is that the House managers have effectively conceded with respect to Article 1 that the president is using powers given to him by the Constitution. Unlike Article 2, where they claim the president is usurping Congress's impeachment power. And in Article 1, the core of the argument is basically that the president was badly motivated. That is, the president could, if he had genuine reason to believe that military aid to this ally would, because of the underlying corruption, all get wasted, he could, as commander-in-chief, decide that it would hurt the national security to actually carry through with giving the aid, that he had an obligation to violate the Impoundment Act and to withhold the aid. And the whole essence of the House manager's case is, if we stitch together all of these bits of evidence, we can show that the president was corruptly motivated.
Well, Professor Tribe and Professor LaCroix, hang on. I'll let you finish your thought when we come back from a quick break. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with two constitutional scholars about what they're seeing in the Senate impeachment trial of President Donald Trump. I'm joined today by Alison LaCroix. She is a law and history professor at the University of Chicago and author of a number of books, including The Ideological Origins of American Federalism. And Lawrence Tribe joins us as well. He's a professor of constitutional law at Harvard University, consulted with House Democrats on the impeachment proceedings, author of many books, including most recently, To End a Presidency, The Power of Impeachment and the Constitution. And Professor Tribe, before the break, you were talking about the fact that the argument can be made that the president operated within the guidelines provided by Article 1 of the Constitution, but that the task is to prove corrupt intent, as you were saying. But let me ask you just to follow up on that here. I mean, we've got, for example, a question or comment coming in from a listener on Twitter who says, Adam Schiff spent 12 hours telling the Senate they had to assume that Trump withheld aid to Ukraine unless Ukraine announced investigations because Schiff had no direct evidence that could prove it. And then the listener says, also, that's not illegal. Demanding corruption investigations for aid is common. I mean, is there a challenge here, according to this listener, in finding proof of that corrupt intent?
Well, not really. I mean, to go back to where I was, the president was acting within the technical limits of Article 2 of the Constitution. And Article 1, this is what's confusing, Article 1 of the Articles of Impeachment is the article that says he was doing it in order to benefit himself politically, not to benefit the country. But the listener is incorrect, I think, in suggesting that all of the evidence of his corrupt intent is indirect. It could hardly be more direct. We have people who spoke to the president. We have massive evidence centered on but not limited to that so-called perfect call in which the president is asking not for a systematic investigation into corruption in Ukraine as a condition of giving the aid, but he's asking for an announcement of an investigation into his political adversary. He doesn't do that with any country except Ukraine. He doesn't do that until the moment Biden has announced for president. The evidence is overwhelming and compelling that he did it for his political purposes in order to cheat in the next election. Now, if I were representing the president, I would say, well, if the evidence is all that compelling, why do you need these witnesses? Why do you need all of these documents? But that's what Adam Schiff did so brilliantly. I think one commentator on television this morning talked about how Schiff described the negative space. That is, you paint the entire picture. It's a glorious portrait, ugly really, of how the president used the powers of his office for his own benefit. And then there are these little tiny gaps. They're not gaps that need to be filled in order to know what this is a picture of, but they are gaps that we would like to have filled in order to have a complete painting so that we would know for the future exactly how this corrupt president managed to achieve his aims and would have achieved them but for the whistleblower. And it is that filling in, I would say, if I were now responding to the president's team, the reason we want all of that evidence is not to prove our case. We've proved it. But the reason we need it is that otherwise you can make a big deal out of these little gaps. And really, it's your burden. Now that we have overwhelming proof that this president has abused his power dangerously, if you want to ask for an acquittal, you've got to show that there's something in those negative spaces that would somehow exonerate the president. That if we really knew what the president and Bolton said to one another, we would realize that his purposes were noble. The burden now falls to the president's team to fill in the gaps, right. And therefore they're the ones who ought to be asking for Bolton's and Mulvaney's testimony.
Well, so let me ask both of you then, and Professor LaCroix, I'll turn to you first here. Is what is in those negative spaces essentially politics? Because it seems as if even though impeachment is in the Constitution, it is an imperfect tool even within the document of the Constitution, if we're balancing between legal arguments and political ones here. I mean, if politics will always be part of this picture, then can we ever really have a I don't want to say perfect, but a reliable impeachment proceeding? We've only had a couple of them. There's a small number. But what do you think about that?
Well, I would distinguish between political and partisan. And I think this is something that I often find important in teaching, in teaching constitutional law, because we have, and the Constitution uses this these terms, and so did people at the time the Constitution was drafted. And I think when we hear political, we think low, kind of ugly, gaming, and we, I think, assume that it means partisan. But it need not mean that. And so when we talk in constitutional law terms about the political branches or apolitical questions, a political question that a court can't hear, generally what we mean is a question or an issue that has to do with the powers of the political branches, which are Congress and the presidency. And so in constitutional law terms, that I think gives us some room to say, and you can find Hamilton and lots of others from the founding generation talking in these terms, we know that those players have other impulses, imperatives, pressures on them. And so the founders, to the extent we look to them, which I think is appropriate here for lots of reasons, including that we don't have many data points, I think the founders were very savvy about this and drafted the Constitution knowing that on the one hand, if you write the document and construct a structure, because that's what they were doing, they weren't just writing a document. If you build a structure such that the structure itself does not contain any sort of emergency fail-safes, the structure will probably collapse. And they had that as an experience of living in the British North American world, you know, for decades. So they think about executions of kings and arguments about kings being called before Parliament. And so impeachment, amendment, even the way the Constitution talks about elections, these are all political processes that the Constitution nonetheless says, let's bring within the ambit of the structure. So to your question specifically, I think, yes, the impeachment proceedings always have a political and indeed a partisan nature. But I don't think it is a good argument to say this is just political, because at some level we know that. And the question again then becomes, well, at what point are we talking not about executive power should be robust to protect the United States from its enemies and foes and to maintain national security? Instead, we're saying, when is the president profiting from his or her office for personal gain and indeed giving foreign nations unwarranted power to do that? And that is exactly the kind of thing that Americans and drafters of the Constitution all the way forward have been worried about, you know, this idea that foreign nations would get undue influence. So it's sort of at the heart of the political and the partisan concerns to talk in these terms.
Now, that's really interesting, Professor LaCroix. But let me just piggyback off that. And Professor Tribe, let me ask you, I can't really fully step away from this concern that I think many people have, that the partisanship part of this is so powerful right now. It's so profound. For a lot of people, it feels virtually unparalleled, although I suppose you can look to other points in U.S. history and find intense partisanship in American government. But, you know, do we have the structures within the Constitution to tolerate this amount of partisanship, or is it fundamentally coloring how effective an impeachment can be?
Well, I think you've asked, Meghna, the most profound question, that is, can the impeachment power truly protect the country as it was designed to in an era of such deeply partisan division and polarization, colored also by social media and by the tunnel vision in which people just get the news they want to get and in which people are talking about different versions of reality, different versions of fact? And I don't think we have the answer to that question yet. But I want to go back to something that Allison said. I think she was being a little too polite when she talked about the execution of kings. It was the assassination of kings. That is, Benjamin Franklin in the early days in designing, being involved in designing the Constitution, was quite explicit that the reason we needed an impeachment power is that we really didn't want to replicate the European experience in which the only way to get rid of a mad king or the only way to get rid of someone who was in it for him or herself was to kill them. We needed some way of taming violence, some way of channeling it. And the framers weren't stupid. They knew perfectly well that they were dealing with an intensely political process. It was both political and legal. The very boundary between the two is permeable. And they knew perfectly well that when they gave the power to try impeachments to a political body, the Senate, rather than to the Supreme Court, which they considered doing, that they were asking a lot of people. They ultimately, you know, had an oath to do impartial justice, though those words aren't in the Constitution. But there's an inherent tension there. We know that a lot of the Democrats, some of the ones who were running against this president, certainly are not impartial in the usual sense of having no bias.
Right.
We certainly know that McConnell and Graham and others who've committed from the beginning not to be impartial are going to have a hard time doing impartial justice. But the framers hoped that people would rise to the occasion, that they would be able, even though they were biased, even though politics would necessarily, in the low sense as well as the high sense of politics, infect and inflect their decision making, that they could set that aside and try to do justice. And I still, maybe I'm too optimistic, have the view, when I talk to people like Schumer, they say that they look around the chamber and they're amazed by how Republicans who probably haven't bothered to listen to any of the hearings before, the Intelligence Committee hearings and so on, are listening raptly to the presentation that is being stitched together, despite all of the negative spaces, by the presentation about what this president did. And in the end, their fear of losing their seats, their fear of revenge by Trump may prevent them from doing what they know is right. Yeah. But if the country comes to feel that this president is an abomination, that will mean that even though he's not removed in time, he will lose massively in November. That's the way the impeachment process may work. As Nancy Pelosi has said, impeachment is forever. Even if he's acquitted by what looks like a whitewash rather than a real trial, impeachment itself is forever, and maybe future presidents will realize they can't get away with murder.
Or maybe not.
Or maybe not.
Well, Professor LaCroix, I'll come back to you here in just a second, but let's quickly go to a caller. Jackie is calling from West Hartford, Connecticut. Jackie, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. And this is actually a follow-up to your comment. I wanted to just ask the panel on your thoughts on this observation in question. From my vantage point, it seems like over the last 20 years, both parties are putting party over country. And what I've also seen over the last 20 years is that the legislative branch is deferring more and more to the executive branch on all kinds of matters. So given those two observations, and if you agree with them, I'd just like to know how you think these trends are impacting the way the founders set up the impeachment process and if it's going to be able to work in this setting today. And again, thank you so much for your thoughts.
Well, so Jackie, thank you so much for that. And Professor LaCroix, let me just piggyback off Jackie's question and add this, because Alexander Hamilton's getting a lot of mentions this week, and we've talked to about him a little bit already. So let's look at Federalist 65, if I think that's right, Federalist 65, where Hamilton makes this impassioned argument that the Senate is the right place for an impeachment trial to happen, right? He says, where else than in the Senate could have been found a tribunal sufficiently dignified or sufficiently independent? What other body would likely to feel confidence enough in its own situation to preserve unawed and uninfluenced the necessary impartiality between an individual accused and the representatives of the people, his accusers? And then he goes on to say, you could not find that same impartiality in or dignity in the United States Supreme Court, that there were too few justices on the Supreme Court to render a kind of fairness that the Senate could. But given the question that we just heard from the caller, is that still possible in the Senate? Hamilton's making a lot of presumptions about how the Senate operates, which may not hold true today.
Well, and we see an echo of this, I think, in Chief Justice Roberts' comment yesterday, where he admonished, in his words, the House managers and the President's counsel to remember that they are addressing the world's greatest deliberative body. And that's a very Hamiltonian sense of the Senate. I mean, I think certainly the Senate, as people like Hamilton and the founders thought of it, did occupy a somewhat different space. Senators were elected by the states instead of by the people directly. And that was by design. It was to be a kind of upper house, more reasoned debate, long, long speeches, longer terms. And so that might make us blanch a little bit and think, oh, well, that's starting to sound anti-democratic now. Those sound like elite people who are in there for life and very insulated. But I think another way to think about it, and this gets to the caller's question as well, is to say, well, if you think about this in terms of branches, what we're now seeing is the legislative branch not deferring to the executive responding with hostility and jealousy of its powers. But this also goes to the question, first, the status of the executive power in the last 20 years, and second, how to think about impeachment in terms of democracy. So first, executive power. I think it is uncontrovertible that certainly since September 11th, 2001, the expansion of executive power is something that scholars have written about, that government lawyers, presidents have discussed. And that's true whether you're talking about President Bush, Obama, Trump. And the sense accurately at some level that national security requires it, and indeed that is the specific domain of the president. So we had arguments going back to the Bush administration about the unitary executive, and executive power cannot be trammeled or challenged or even defined. And now, you know, maybe we're seeing a response to that. Some people will then be uncomfortable with that, thinking that the last 20 years are the norm. And I'm not trying to make some sort of pendulum swing argument here, but I do think that the legislative branch does have a duty not to defer to the executive when the executive is defining the terms of its own power. And then on the democracy
point... Well, actually, Professor, if you can, I just have to take a quick break here. So hang on here for just a moment. We are talking with two constitutional legal scholars about what they're seeing in the impeachment trial of President Donald Trump. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, the Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with two constitutional scholars about what they're seeing in the impeachment trial of President Donald Trump. Allison LaCroix joins us. She's a law and history professor at the University of Chicago. And Lawrence Tribe is also with us as well. He's a professor of constitutional law at Harvard University. And Professor Tribe, let me just turn to you on this question of whether the Senate in 2020 is the best and right place for an impeachment trial. And I ask because I'm still quite taken by those words that Hamilton uses in Federalist 65, that the Senate ought to be a place where it is unawed and uninfluenced. Awe as in A-W-E. And Professor LaCroix, before the break, pointed out that perhaps the Senate is no longer a deliberative body that is unawed by the executive. So can we... Should the Senate be the place where an impeachment trial happens?
Well, first of all, I agree with Professor LaCroix that the Senate isn't quite what it used to be, or at least what we imagine, some of us imagine it might have been or Hamilton hoped it would be, and how quaint it sounded for the Chief Justice to use that old image of the Senate as the world's greatest deliberative body when it appears not often to be deliberating at all. But the question of whether it's the right place, the best place, reminds me of a comment Winston Churchill once made about democracy, that it was the worst form of government imaginable except for all the others. So the question, it was a question really that bedeviled the framers, was where shall we put this awesome power? We don't want the Congress to basically overwhelm the executive. We don't want every president to be looking over his or today, hopefully someday, her shoulder at what Congress would like. On the other hand, we don't want an all-powerful executive. And so they settled on the Senate partly because they couldn't think of any other place that would work. I mean, as Allison points out, their concern about the Supreme Court was that it might be too easily corruptible. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't just its relatively small size. It was the fact that some of the justices would have been appointed by the president and therefore would be beholden to him. So now you look at Kavanaugh, you look at Gorsuch, and you ask, well, what are they going to do? But it was true in the United States versus Nixon that Nixon appointees all held that the president is not above the law. So now the hope is that a Senate that is elected in a sensible way will be the least terrible place to have an impeachment trial. But if it turns out, as it did in vote after vote, that they march in lockstep behind the president, 53-47, then the system will have to correct itself by voting out of office people like Susan Collins, who are always concerned and they furrow their brows, but in the end they
fall into line,
follow the leader. Yeah. The framers, I think, recognized, and this is why they had the impeachment power, that we might one day have a renegade president, a president who regarded the law as simply a plaything for the president's own benefit. What they didn't necessarily count on is that we might have a renegade Senate as well. Senate led by someone beholden to the same foreign leader as the president. You know, when Nancy Pelosi said all roads lead to Moscow, to Putin, she had in mind Moscow Mitch as well as the president. There's increasingly distressing evidence that the president isn't the only one beholden to Russian oligarchs to some degree. So we have a system in which the role of hostile foreign powers in our system has become rather pernicious. And there are systemic and structural problems as well.
Right.
I mean, the Senate is a crazy body. Before the 17th Amendment, when senators were selected by legislators, it wasn't very democratic, but at least there was some rationale for having a separate group like that, sort of an upper house. There is no rationale anymore. Yeah. They're elected directly by the people, but in dramatic violation of the one-person, one-vote principle, with Wyoming having as many senators as California, even though it has a small fraction of the number of people. Yeah. So we may need to rethink the whole design after this period.
The whole design of the Senate, the whole design of the Constitution, the whole design of the Constitution.
Yeah, I think more and more people are thinking that the Constitution is not something we should necessarily worship. We need to take it seriously. We need to get rid of a president who can't even read it, let alone care about it. But we need to rethink whether it serves our purposes in the 21st century as it's currently structured.
It's a fundamental design, not just adding on amendments you're talking
about. That's right.
Okay. Well, let's talk for a second, and I'll go to a caller here to ask this question. There is actually one Supreme Court justice in the middle of all of this going on in the Senate right now, and that's Chief Justice John Roberts. So, Don from Buffalo, New York, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you. My question is, I recently read in the New York Times an article about the power that Chief Justice Roberts does have. Apparently, he has more power than Mitch McConnell on proclaiming evidence and witnesses to the trial. So I was just wondering what their take on that is. According to the Constitution, they have the right to do that.
Yeah. Don, thank you for that question. Professor LaCroix?
Well, the Constitution doesn't have a lot to say specifically. I mean, it basically just says that the Chief Justice shall preside when the president is tried. And we have some Supreme Court case law about impeachments, although not of the president, impeachment proceedings of federal judges and a few others, where the question was, can the Supreme Court or a federal court sort of oversee the procedures that the Senate decides to use and that or that the Chief Justice implicitly or explicitly authorizes. And the Supreme Court in a case called Nixon versus U.S., but it's Judge Walter Nixon, not President Richard Nixon, basically said, well, no, the rules, the Senate may determine the rules unless they go beyond some line that we don't really want to draw now. So, yeah, the Chief Justice has tremendous power. I think Chief Justice Roberts has indicated, suggested so far, that he's probably not going to play a huge role, but there's certainly precedent. And again, given our small data sample, these precedents matter. So in the impeachment of President Andrew Johnson in 1868, Chief Justice Salmon P. Chase was presiding. He was more political in the sense that everyone knew he had been in Lincoln's cabinet and was a radical Republican who therefore supported a more aggressive Reconstruction than President Johnson wanted, which was the underlying issue in the Johnson impeachment. And so Chase, as Chief Justice presiding, was very, very central to the proceedings, to the point where people criticized him. They spent hours trying to figure out evidentiary rulings. He wanted to have a vote in the case of a tie. He said he should have the ability to cast a vote. And I think a lot of people looking back thought that was too much. Mm-hmm. Chase came in for a huge amount of criticism for that. And I think everything we know about Chief Justice Roberts suggests he would shy away from that kind of role. I think one thing that people who watch the court and over his tenure have observed is that he really does want to build the institution and cares about the authority of the court.
Right. And he's actually written or spoken quite extensively about his concern that the court is being seen as a political body now or a partisan body. So it is something he's expressed care about. But Professor Tribe, go ahead, your thoughts.
Well, I was going to say that the Chief Justice certainly has a possible role in breaking ties, just as Chief Justice Chase did it twice. There may be no alternative. I mean, when it's 50-50, there is no vice president to break a tie because the vice president has no role in an impeachment trial of a president. But if the Chief Justice does break that tie, in the end, the Senate can override him again by 51 votes. And the net result is, since it takes a majority to do anything, like subpoena Bolton, for example, if you don't have 51 votes in the absence of the Chief Justice, the status quo is preserved. You can't get that subpoena. That's sort of a technical answer, but the bottom line is we know that this Chief Justice, and I know him from his student days. He was a student of mine also. We know that he's not somebody who would exult in taking a role that would be seen by anybody as political. He doesn't want to be merely a potted plant, but he's simply preserving decorum. That's his principal role. On the other hand, I strongly support an effort that was made by Senator Chris Van Hollen to at least have motions for evidence, that is, for the production of evidence, go initially to the Chief Justice so that he would indicate what an ordinary, rational resolution of the issues of, for example, relevance would be. And 51 senators could override him, but at least they would have some indication of what a genuinely neutral, umpire-like observer would say about the matter. I think that's something that ought to be taken seriously. Even a modest Chief Justice who doesn't want to play a massive role could be put on the spot to make an initial ruling about whether Hunter Biden is too far outside the bounds of relevance to be called, for example. But in general, I agree with Professor LaCroix that we don't have a situation in which, even though the Constitution leaves open the possibility, our history suggests nothing about the Chief Justice that would require him to play anything more than a traffic cop sort of role.
Yeah. Well, let's go to another caller. Let's go to Mark, who's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air.
Hello.
Go ahead.
So I have a couple things here, but you had a gentleman on, and I don't know if it's this gentleman speaking right now, but he mentioned, when he was mentioning Trump's legal team, how they were all white. And I was just wondering what relevance that had to any part of the conversation, or was that just kind of a dig to old white lawyers? I don't know what that meant. But we can discuss that. That gentleman can answer that. So I have a couple of comments regarding, you know, kind of hypocrisy during this whole thing. I think we can all say that politics is very hypocritical depending on whether there's a Democrat or a Republican in office.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just kind of, you know, right now under the situation, the hypocrisy happening now is that, you know, we have the Democrats right now saying certain things that they weren't saying just a few short years ago, say when Bill Clinton was being impeached for having sexual relations in the White House. Nancy Pelosi, Nadler, and Schumer all said the opposite of what they're saying now.
Mm.
And I think that can all be pointed out, but nobody on the left talks about it. They don't talk about it on the other places, and I don't hear it being called out here. I don't hear Obama being called out when he said on a stage on a live mic to Russia, I'll be more lenient. You know, I don't hear anybody talking about Biden. How about Biden's quid pro quo?
So, Mark, you've actually pointed out something which I want to let Professor Larry Tribe respond to. Thank you for your call. I mean, I actually think in terms of Mark's latter point about Democrats today saying things that are opposite of what they did in 1998 is a fair one, because also Republicans today are saying things that are completely the opposite of what they were saying in 1998 regarding their defense of the sort of the moral standard of the office of the presidency as well. Hypocrisy doesn't necessarily seem to be news to me in terms of politics in America. This is kind of my quick view on that. I'm happy to hear your view on that, Professor Tribe, and also what Mark was wondering about your comment about the president's legal team being all white men.
Well, as far as hypocrisy is concerned, I do agree that hypocrisy is an equal opportunity offender. But I do not agree that there is some inconsistency between the position that Pelosi and Schumer and Nadler were taking on the Clinton impeachment and this position. There's simply no comparison between the threat to the country of someone who would use the powers of the presidency, powers over almost $400 million of aid in order to benefit his own reelection, and having sex with an intern, abusing one's employer power in that way, and then lying about it. That was terrible. And actually, lots of Democrats condemned Nixon for it, condemned Clinton for it. But it was not a high crime and misdemeanor in any meaningful sense. So I don't think that's a particularly good example. The business about equal opportunity offense is true generally, but to assume that sort of everybody is equally guilty of it in every circumstance is simply too simplistic. And as to my comment about the nature of the president's defense team, I have to admit that was just an irrelevant observation. I was about to say something and then I just noticed that they were all white guys. So okay. I mentioned it. Big deal.
Fair enough. Live radio. So look, we have 2 minutes left. And Professor LaCroix, I want to actually return to something that Professor Tribe said earlier, because this is a momentous period in United States history. And Professor Tribe, a couple of minutes ago, said maybe what we are heading towards is the necessity of looking at the fundamental structure of the Constitution. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it would be wonderful if people generally thought seriously about the Constitution. I think it's needed, it's necessary. And, you know, one of the things that is supposed to make us feel better about the impeachment process is it crosses over these branches. You have the House, you have the Senate, you have the Chief Justice. It's very unusual. But to make us feel like the people are there and represented, we need to feel confident about how those people who represent the people are elected. So that's, I think, we are overdue for conversations about things like how the democratic process works, how elections work, thinking about the whole structure of the Constitution, and also not venerating it and saying, well, it was written this way in 1787 and this is what people meant, even though we can – no one will know what they meant, and therefore we should venerate it. I think it's healthy to be engaged and even thinking about restructuring.
Mm. Well, Professor Tribe, we've got less than a minute to go. I'm also wondering if this speaks to the fragility of our democracy at this moment.
Well, I think our democracy is fragile. We need to recognize that there's no guarantee that a democratic republic will live forever. Public engagement, public deliberation, public participation, not only at the ballot box, which needs to be more thoroughly protected from cyber attack and from voter suppression and from gerrymandering, but in public conversation, in deliberative democracy. Rethinking everything from the ground up, all of that is, in effect, the great gift of this moment, because dangerous though it is, it makes us all and our students and our friends think deeply about how to keep our republic.
Well, Lawrence Tribe is a professor of constitutional law at Harvard University and author of To End a Presidency. Professor Tribe, thank you so much.
Thank you, Magda.
And Allison LaCroix, of law and history professor at the University of Chicago and author of The Ideological Origins of American Federalism. Professor LaCroix, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.